Bagthorpe's Abroad by Helen Cresswell. Chapter 4. The relief of Mrs. Fosdyke's headache by her Guinness was only temporary, and she took the next day off. "That'll give 'em time to get that room to rights," she reflected. "Not that it ever will be, of course. I used to fair enjoy dusting in there. Nothing much left to dust now, I suppose, and if them alcoholic fumes has got into the furnishings, it'll smell for everlasting of a gin palace." Her employer's mood was not noticeably more cheerful. Mrs. Bagthorpe's yoga and deep breathing helped her to cope with ordinary run-of-the-mill stresses, but let her down on occasions such as yesterday. She had been in a fair lather over her husband's holiday plans when there was still the goat to come. She did, however, try to think positively, and was also fairly, though not outstandingly, sensible by nature. "If a situation is worrying you," she told herself firmly, "it is best to take positive steps to rectify matters. Take the bull by the horns." The bull, in this case being Mr. Bagthorpe, she requested the telephone number of the man who had rented him the house in Wales. At first he refused. "His name's Jones," he told her. "Look him up in the telephone directory. Ha!" In the end he gave in, and Mrs. Bagthorpe made her call. "That's splendid," she told the others, who had assembled in the kitchen for a mid-morning snack, breakfast having been uneatable. "Mr. Jones says that there is a small cottage on the grounds nearby that will be exactly the thing for Mrs. Fosdyke." "And how much is that going to cost?" demanded Mr. Bagthorpe. "You said a room, Laura. Now it's a cottage that—" "The rent is extremely reasonable," she told him. "So much so, in fact, that I thought I had misheard him, and asked him to repeat it. The figure is no higher than one would expect to pay for a single room. I shall pay it, Henry. I do not want our holiday spoiled by your sulking over such a petty detail." There were only 4 days to go before they left for Wales, and everybody set about assembling the things they wished to take with them. This included a large number of musical instruments. William played the drums, Rosie the violin and cello, and Tess the oboe and piano, though she had been dissuaded from attempting to pack the latter. William was speculating about the viability of dismantling his radio mast in the garden and taking that. "There are a lot of mountains in Wales," he said, "which will interfere with radio waves, and I don't want to risk losing some of my contacts, especially anonymous from Grimsby." Grandma dispatched Jack to the village shop with a request for as many as possible large empty cartons. When he took these up to her, he found the room almost unrecognizable. "Gosh, Grandma," said Jack, "it's completely bare. I don't honestly think there'll be another burglary, you know. Lightning never strikes twice in the same place." This, coming from a member of the Bagthorpe family, was rich. At their house lightning was apt to strike not twice, but with regularity and at frequent intervals. "I cannot exist for 6 weeks without my dearest possessions," Grandma told him. "My room is my solace and my sanctuary, where I can retire to escape the hurly-burly of everyday life." Considering that Grandma was herself responsible for much of the hurly-burly at Unicorn House, and indeed appeared to thrive on it, this struck Jack as strange. "But you're not taking that lot with you, are you? I thought you were just packing them up out of the way of burglars." "I shall not set foot out of this house without them," she replied. When Mr. Bagthorpe saw the mounting heap of luggage in the hall, he immediately ordered everybody to take their stuff back to their rooms and unpack it. "It would take a fleet of cars to move that stuff," he said, "and I am not Paul Getty." Mrs. Bagthorpe intervened. "I have been thinking, Henry," she said. "There are 9 of us to be transported, and naturally quite a lot of luggage. I think that we should hire a minibus." "At the rate this lot are going, a furniture removal van would be more appropriate," he returned. "Don't be silly, Henry," she told him, and went off to order a minibus. As soon as this news reached the rest of the family, they all immediately upped their quantity of luggage. Even Grandpa had a large pile of fishing gear and a portable television set. Mrs. Bagthorpe went down to the village to inquire after Mrs. Fosdyke's headache and invite her to accompany them to Wales. This invitation Mrs. Fosdyke at first pretended to refuse, and at last accepted with a great show of reluctance. This, given Mrs. Fosdyke's earlier pronouncements in the Fiddler's Arms, might strike some people as inconsistent. The truth of the matter, however, was that Mrs. Fosdyke was at least as dependent on the Bagthorpes as they were on her. After only a few days away from them, she would find herself oddly out of sorts and restless. A comparison might be made between this and the withdrawal symptoms suffered by a drug addict. When people were in the vicinity of the Bagthorpes, their adrenaline tended to flow. Mrs. Fosdyke was no exception. Her adrenaline glands were in a constant state of arousal. She was kept on a permanent high. She would never, even under torture, have admitted to liking the Bagthorpes. She was simply addicted to them. Had she been required to live under the same roof for 6 weeks, she might have decided against the venture, but the prospect of having her own private cottage appealed to her greatly. "At least I can have nice, quiet evenings," she told herself, naively. Having accepted the invitation and returned to her duties at Unicorn House, Mrs. Fosdyke became very bossy. She instantly set about ordering large quantities of groceries and provisions from the village shop. "But Mrs. Fosdyke," protested Mrs. Bagthorpe, eyeing dubiously the tall towers and pyramids of packets and cans, "surely we can purchase all these commodities when we get there." "We're going abroad, don't forget," said Mrs. Fosdyke darkly. "I ain't getting stuck anywhere foreign with all kinds of packets on shelves you can't read a word of, and brands you've never heard of, and—" "But we're only going to Wales," Mrs. Bagthorpe said weakly. "I'm sure we'll find—" "My sister in Portsmouth once brought me back a cake mix from Mallorca," Mrs. Fosdyke rambled on regardless, "and I could make neither head nor tail of it, all them foreign instructions, and I ain't sure I should have fancied it anyhow. Threw it in the bin in the end. Have you taken out some insurance?" "Insurance?" echoed Mrs. Bagthorpe, temporarily thrown by this abrupt change of tack. "People that goes abroad usually takes out insurance," said Mrs. Fosdyke lugubriously. "My sister in Portsmouth always does, and tablets from the doctor in case your tummy goes off. Not, of course, that there'll be anything wrong with my cooking. I shan't go lathering everything in olive oil. But it's the water you've got to be careful about, see? I think you ought to take out some insurance, Mrs. Bagthorpe. I do, really." It was fortunate that Mr. Bagthorpe was not around to hear this, the topic of insurance being a highly inflammatory one at the present time. He had already had several very embarrassing telephone conversations with the insurance people over the havoc wreaked by Daisy and her goat. He had been asked to describe the whole incident in writing, and was finding this extremely difficult. "It reads like a script for the Marx Brothers," he told the others, "or a missing last act from King Lear. I doubt whether any insurance inspector in England will be able to take such a claim seriously. They'll never believe it. When I see it put down in black and white, even I don't believe it. And when the premium goes up again, Russell will have to foot the bill. If he'd invested in a good psychiatrist years ago for that unhinged daughter of his, it would have worked out cheaper for everybody in the long run." During those days of preparation for the expedition, there were numerous phone calls to Unicorn House, mainly from Daisy Parker, and for either Rosie or Grandma. These were the only two people in the Bagthorpe menage who liked and sympathized with Daisy. "Keep asking Uncle Bag if I can come," she begged them. "Ask and ask and ask him. Me and Billy Goat Gruff want to go to Wales. There's dragons in Wales. Mummy says so." "That," said Mr. Bagthorpe, when he was told of this, "is exactly the kind of half-baked notion with which Celia has been cramming that brat's head since she was born. She is now reaping her just rewards." "Nonsense, Henry," Grandma said. "You have not an ounce of poetry in your soul. I see no reason at all why Daisy should not accompany us. She would take up very little room." "Room?" echoed Mr. Bagthorpe. "Room? England, Europe, the world, the entire universe would not contain—" "Do not trouble launching into one of your exaggerated tirades," Grandma told him. "Daisy is just a normal, high-spirited 5-year-old. Though, admittedly, unusually creative." "And black," gritted Mr. Bagthorpe, "is white." Despite sustained canvassing on Daisy's behalf by both Rosie and Grandma, she was not to be allowed to accompany the party. Jack himself was relieved. Most dragons breathe fire, he thought, and if Daisy thinks Wales is full of dragons, that means she's back into her fire phase. Also, he thought Daisy herself a sufficiently formidable personality to frighten off any ghosts. This would infuriate Mr. Bagthorpe, who was hoping to establish contact with them, and disappoint both Tess and himself. Jack was not conducting any paranormal experiments, as she was. He was just curious. He also wanted to get Rosie to photograph Zero with his fur standing on end. The day of the departure dawned bright and sunny, and this seemed, mistakenly as it turned out, to augur well for their holiday. At 8 o'clock the minibus arrived. They had made arrangements for it to convey themselves and their luggage to Wales, and then collect them in 6 weeks' time. Mrs. Bagthorpe would follow the bus in convoy, driving the family estate car, to carry excess baggage and for use while they were away. That's a station wagon, by the way. "We do not wish to be cut off entirely from civilization," Mrs. Bagthorpe had laughingly remarked. Most people acquainted with the Bagthorpes would have said that they were at a fair remove from civilization for most of the time. "Look, Squire," the bus driver said to Mr. Bagthorpe when he saw the mountain of luggage assembled in the drive. "This is a minibus, not a bleeding removal van." "We are only taking the barest minimum," Mr. Bagthorpe lied acidly. At that moment there came the sound of spurting gravel. The Parkers had come to make their farewells. "My word, Henry," said Uncle Parker, eyeing the Everest of luggage. "It's easy to see that your lot don't travel with only a toothbrush." Daisy, with Billy Goat Gruff in tow on a long yellow ribbon, began to sob heartily. "One of the things we have to look forward to in the coming weeks, Russell," said Mr. Bagthorpe, "is a respite from the attentions of your deranged daughter. Why have you brought that goat back onto my premises?" "The goat's only crime," replied Uncle Parker, "was to down one scotch too many. I should have thought you could have sympathized with that, Henry." "Wales, ever-singing Wales," murmured Aunt Celia. She was wearing her waterfall outfit again. "Yes, dearest, yes," said Uncle Parker, "though it'll have less to sing about when this lot take up residence." "Uncle Bag's nasty," sobbed Daisy. "Now I shan't never see no dragons." "Look, Daisy," said her father, "pretend Billy Goat Gruff's a dragon, why don't you?" "'Cause he ain't got no fire," sobbed Daisy. "Dragon's got fire." Hearing this, Jack again mentally congratulated his father on his decision to leave Daisy on English soil. It was a 2-hour job to fit the Bagthorpes' minimum of belongings into the 2 vehicles. Twice everything was nearly stowed, and then had to be taken out again and a new start made. Rather like one of those executive desk puzzles," drawled Uncle Parker. "Any executive who could solve this one would deserve to be made chairman of British Rail tomorrow. Not," he added, "that their record with luggage is unspotted." The bus driver put the matter more succinctly. "It's like trying to get a bleeding gallon into a pint pot," he said. "The expression is quart," Mr. Bagthorpe told him coldly. "A quart into a pint pot." "Look, Squire," said the driver, "I said gallon, and I meant bleeding gallon." During this arduous 2 hours, Daisy eventually cheered up, and along with Billy Goat Gruff managed to amuse herself. Nobody had been detailed to watch her movements. This was a pity, as they were later to discover. At last the Bagthorpes and their belongings were crammed into the 2 vehicles. "You're sure that's the lot?" inquired the driver. "Not forgotten the lawnmower or the piano?" "Drive on," Mr. Bagthorpe told him curtly. He had elected to travel in the minibus rather than with his wife, partly because anyone who traveled with the latter would do so with fishing rods waving past his ear, and partly because he suspected that Grandma would hatch plots against him if he were not there. In the end, nobody wanted to sit with Mrs. Bagthorpe. "But I shall have no one to talk to," she protested. "Then it will give you a chance to think your own thoughts," her husband told her. "It's to be hoped they don't send you to sleep at the wheel, ha!" Jack gave the driver instructions for reaching Mrs. Fosdyke's house in Passingham, and by the time they arrived all the passengers, with the exception of Grandma, were well into a noisy rendering of "We'll keep a welcome," which alerted the neighbors, and ensured a watching pair of eyes behind every net curtain. Mrs. Fosdyke emerged, wearing her best peach crepe two-piece and a matching hat with half-veil. She gave the impression that she was expecting to be personally greeted by the Prince and Princess of Wales on crossing the border, and Mr. Bagthorpe said as much. "You're late," she said accusingly as she mounted the steps. "Been sat waiting near on 2 hour, I have." Jack, picturing her sitting expectantly, fully packed, on the edge of a chair in her kitchen, all dressed up, let out a smothered laugh. She gave him a sharp look, but nonetheless elected to sit next to him. The choice was not wide. The only other remaining seat was next to Mr. Bagthorpe himself. "At least you, lady, haven't brought your three-piece suite along with you," said the driver, hauling up her one suitcase, lavishly festooned with labels bearing the legend "Wales" in bright red capitals. "Quite a bit of the stuff in the back's hers," Jack told him, in the interests of fairness. The minibus was so well provisioned that, had it been cut off in an unseasonable blizzard, its occupants could have survived for a month. Once Mrs. Fosdyke and her luggage were installed, Mrs. Bagthorn pipped merrily on her hooter from the rear, and the expedition was under way. The minibus driver had probably never had such noisy passengers, even those bound for football matches. The Bagthorpes had a long and well-loved list of car games that they always played on journeys. These involved a great deal of shrieking, hooting, arguing, and in Grandma's case, cheating. "You can't hardly hear yourself drive," Jack heard the driver mutter under his breath. After a time, thinking it only polite, Jack asked him if he would like to join in. "No thanks, son," was the reply. "I've got enough on, trying to concentrate on the road as it is." Frequent stops in towns were made for Grandma, who had a weak bladder. Or, at any rate, she said she had. On these occasions, the rest of the party scattered at speed and disappeared into various shops. The driver then had great difficulty in reassembling his passengers. On the last of these stops, he said to Grandma, "Look, lady, this is the last town. We're over the Welsh border in a couple of miles, and from then on it'll have to be hedges." At this, Grandma fixed him with a quelling look, and the rest guffawed. "Over the Welsh border, did you say?" asked Mrs. Fosdyke nervously. Then, to Jack, "Are you sure we don't need passports?" As the boundary line was crossed, the whole party, with the exception of Mrs. Fosdyke, let out a rousing cheer and burst into another chorus of, "We'll keep a welcome." "Are they Welsh, do you think?" whispered Mrs. Fosdyke to Jack, prodding him and pointing at a group of walkers with haversacks and woolly hats. He wondered what Mrs. Fosdyke thought the Welsh ought to look like. "She probably expects them to be barefoot," he thought, "and wearing animal skins, or waving spears with rings through their noses." Once they were well and truly into Wales, the party became more subdued. They stopped playing games, and instead looked out of the windows at the rolling hills, the rocks, and falling streams. There were few signs of human habitation. The farther they went, the wilder and more deserted the landscape. At present, rock-climbing and cross-country trekking were strings to nobody's bows, but it began to look as if they soon would be. "You really do not do things by halves, Henry," said Grandma, who was evidently having much the same thoughts. "I had expected scenery, but nothing so drastic as this. I have brought no walking shoes. I do not see myself in flat heels." "I was just thinking the same, Mrs. Bagthorpe, dear," said Mrs. Fosdyke. Mr. Bagthorpe glowered at them. Neither was included in the party at his own wish, and now here they were complaining already. Also, he himself didn't care much for the look of the terrain they were now traversing, though he would have died rather than admit this. "People who cannot adjust should not travel abroad," he told them. "We can always make inquiries about trains back." Then all at once the landscape became greener and softer, and they found themselves descending into a small wooded valley with a cluster of houses at the foot. "Here we are, then," said the driver. "Lossilly ahead." As they drove through the main street, the Bagthorpes noted with relief that there seemed to be several shops. At home they all made regular forays to the village for extra rations and so on. The driver drew up and asked a woman the way to Tai Silion Duan. Mrs. Fosdyke poked Jack yet again. "That one spoke English, at any rate," she hissed. The minibus reached the end of the village and entered a wide stone gateway. There it drove up a dark, heavily wooded and overgrown drive, and drew up finally in front of a large gray stone house. The driver switched off the engine. There was a little silence, followed by the sound of Mrs. Bagthorpe's car also drawing up. "This seems to be it, Squire," said the driver. "Rather you than me." End of chapter 4.